This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. I've had a question about the principle of free speech for a long time, and it's never been answered for me adequately, not in my own mind and not by anybody else. The question is, when is it precisely when the state cannot allow free speech? So when I was in New York, I went to talk to one of the leading experts on the principle and law of free speech in the United States. And in my conversation with Nadine Strossen, the longtime president of the ACLU, I think I found the answer. An answer that I think even she was a bit surprised to find out. This is my interview with Nadine Strossen. So I'm sitting on the block that I've lectured about in my lectures at Columbia University. I think it's one of the most important city blocks in American history because much of the New Deal was formulated in the apartments here. I don't know about this building, possibly in this building, but certainly on this block. And many of the wars of the 20th century were first dreamed up, really, right here by Columbia professors in these set of buildings that are mostly occupied, or at least have been occupied by Columbia professors. Today, I'm speaking to someone who is not a Columbia professor, which is maybe why she allowed me in. This is Nadine Strossen, who was the longtime president of the ACLU and has taught at the New York Law School.
For many years.
And so she doesn't have the Columbia baggage that is problematic for me, as a lot of people know. But she's also been a hero of mine for a long time because she's been, well, for a lot of reasons. I mean, she's really been, I'm going to stop. I'm going to address you now directly. You have been, certainly everyone would acknowledge, a leader in sort of the civil libertarian movement. That's one thing that's very important to me. Powerful, principled, and consistent on free speech throughout your career, as far as I know. And you also are not afraid of being ecumenical. So you work with leftists. I think you still identify as a progressive of some sort, maybe not liberal. I don't know.
Thank you so much, Thad. I consider myself more of a civil libertarian than anything else. On the Reason Cruise, where you and I first crossed paths in person, I first heard a term that I find kind of appealing, libertarian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you also stand out in that way, that you've been willing to work with anyone, conservatives who occasionally are pro-free speech, libertarians, of course, and liberals where you can find them, who are willing to take a stand. And this is kind of another reason that I'm here today, is that is more in question than ever, whether liberals are still committed, people on the left are still committed to the free speech principle, right? And so you also have a book you're working on that's going to be coming out in May, and which is about that very, I think, largely about that very question in part. And can you just give a capsule summary of the book?
Absolutely. The title is Hate: Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. So I fully embrace the commitment by the activists we've seen on campus and elsewhere who are agitating for social justice, racial justice, gender justice, challenging mass incarceration and discrimination in the criminal justice system, but somehow have come to believe, apparently, that freedom of speech is their enemy rather than their most time-tested essential ally. And even though I have been writing and debating about should there be free speech, even for those whose ideas we hate, including even those who oppose civil liberties, I've been debating that ever since the ACLU's famous or infamous case in Skokie in the late 1970s. Depending on your point of view, we were heroes or we were devils. And that it's a perennial debate throughout American history and in civil libertarian and civil rights circles. So I had reached a point where I was quite frankly sick of the topic. And in the 90s or so, after the first wave of campus hate speech codes, which I wrote, what people tell me is still the leading law review article, arguing that they are unconstitutional. And indeed, every single hate speech code that has been challenged has been struck down as unconstitutional. And I just said, I have nothing new to say on this issue. Those who are advocating censorship have nothing new to say. I'll let other people carry on the fight. And then in the last couple of years, as watching the opposition to freedom of speech by those who had most benefited from it in order to be able to organize and agitate for racial equality and women's equality and immigrants' rights and LGBT rights, when they didn't understand that because they weren't familiar with the history, I felt as an advocate, I do have to raise my voice again. Clearly, I and others who have advocated freedom for hateful speech and other speech that is hated have not done an effective job of persuading those who are on the liberal and the progressive end of the spectrum. And I welcome a challenge. So that was the challenge that I embraced in this book. And I am nervous about the reception that it's going to get. I not to sound immodest, I think it's persuasive. So I do feel confident that if people will read the book, they may very well change a hostility toward free speech. But my challenge is going to be to get them to read it when they know they're going to disagree with me.
You even had a problem with your publisher originally, is this right?
I didn't know about that problem. After the book had been enthusiastically acquired by Oxford University Press on the trade side, I was chosen, interestingly enough, by a so-called diversity committee of staff members at Oxford as one of the authors. They wanted to come in to speak at a diversity luncheon. And it was quite an honor because they publish many more books than they can, whose authors they can accommodate. So clearly people were very interested in my book. It was a very lively discussion with excellent questions. And afterwards, a couple of the staff members, including some with quite high positions, confessed to me that they had opposed Oxford publishing the book just on the basis of the title and the perspective. And then they read it and they were persuaded.
Which is evidence for the argument that you're making, right?
Yeah. And of course, I don't expect every single person in the world to accept every argument or even the bottom line argument. But what I do hope will happen, Thad, is that it might help to bridge these polarizing divides we have on campus, mirroring society generally, so that if you oppose censoring hate speech, you must be a racist, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen those accusations made on campus where even posters that simply advocate freedom of speech have been denounced as hate speech.
Yep. Yeah, it is a common position on the left now, both among liberals, I think, and certainly among the socialist left, I guess we can call it, that freedom of speech is basically a front for reactionary racist politics.
Which is so odd when you consider who actually wields power in this country. Aside from certain elite campuses, we have a Republican Congress, a Republican president, Republican governors, and local government officials around the country. And not that I equate Republican. I mean, there's a lot of diversity under that term. But basically, people that you would not presume to be disposed toward enforcing liberal or progressive right. values when it comes to enforcing the inevitably vague and subjective so-called standards in hate speech laws. I mean, one person's hateful, offensive speech is somebody else's beloved, cherished speech. So not surprisingly, Black Lives Matter expression has been attacked by politicians and officials all over the country as hate speech against police officers and against white people. I just read a news story today, again, that was harking back to an incident on a campus in Texas where a Latino student wrote an editorial in which he was denouncing white people and white privilege. And that was attacked as hate speech in the most vicious way, leading to death threats against him. So make no mistake about it. Those who have the power to enforce these codes are not necessarily going to share the liberal pro-civil rights equality values of those who think they want it.
Right. We have a Republican Congress, and we have how many Republican state legislatures? And so what they are demanding, these activists calling for hate speech codes or laws, is for Republicans now to have more power in determining what speech is allowed.
And what else would be targeted aside from Black Lives Matter and other, you know, the protests of the pipeline, the Native Americans and the Dreamer protests, but also the kneel-ins and the opposition or the, you know, symbolic refusal to salute the flag or to sing the national anthem. That has been attacked as hateful against the United States.
Right. And so we have,
there's a blend of accusations of anti-patriotism, seditious undermining of national security, and the label hate speech, interestingly enough.
Free speech, I want to argue, and we can get into this in more depth later, but is never in the interest of the state, I think, that it always has. It needs to curtail certain speech always, and not just the speech that we often talk about. Hate speech is the least of it, but we'll get into that in a minute. But so a lot of people might say, Nadine Strauss, and you're paranoid. You have your handful of 20-something or 30-something junior editors at Oxford Press who might not have liked your book, but they ended up wanting to publish it anyway, and you're getting published anyway, so there you go. What else do we have? We have on Fox News, we have reports of these crazy 19-year-old SJWs all over the campuses calling for hate speech codes, but they're not going to be taking office anytime soon. But we actually do have some evidence, which is several polls have been taken, which show a very clear trend among younger people, people under 30, toward seeking, wanting hate speech codes, you know,
or any speech that is that they consider offensive. And and thank you for making that point, Thad, because I am a little bit skeptical of the anecdotal nature of the dramatic reports we get about specific incidents on campuses, the Middleburys and the Evergreens and the Berkeleys. I assume that those are not necessarily representative, but the surveys are consistent, and some of them have been attacked for their methodology. And those are fair points. But if you look at just a whole host of surveys that have been taken by reputable organizations and ideologically diverse organizations over a number of years now, you do see that demographic trend. And I see that demographic trend even within the ACLU and other organizations that traditionally have been committed to free speech. It's the younger staff members across other ethnic and gender and demographic lines that seem to be the ones that have the least support for free speech. Now, it could be that And there could be a rational explanation for that in the sense that they haven't lived through the history that us older folks have more dramatically lived through of censorship being consistently wielded against causes that were dear to college students, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the civil rights movement, civil rights speakers. This is, to me, so ironic. The very rationales that are being asserted today to supposedly justify, quote, protecting college students from hearing hateful speakers are the exact same rationales that were made by many universities, not only in the South, to keep civil rights speakers off campus, that they were dangerous, that they were violent, that they were leading to a corruption of our society and attacking the status quo, that they were psychologically harmful and frightening. And so students now I think because of a lot of publicity about cases such as Citizens United and other cases involving conservative, wealthy, powerful corporate speakers, have forgotten that throughout history, it's always been those on the margins, the dissenters, the dissidents, those who challenge the status quo, who have to depend on freedom of speech. And that's not a coincidence. There's a reason why that will continue to be the case.
We have another piece of evidence that's, to me, the most significant possibly, which is this letter that came out from within the ACLU just a few months ago from staff. And I think how many hundreds of people are on staff now?
I'm so bad at numbers. It was a troublingly high number.
The overall staff nationally, I think, is in several hundred.
Multiple hundreds.
It was, I think, a fourth or a third of the staff signed a letter in which they said what? I mean, something that I thought was quite stunning given the history of the ACLU.
There was at least the argument that the ACLU should no longer continue to defend freedom of speech for racists or... You know, I haven't read it for a while. Perhaps it's just said the ACLU should reconsider its position. Maybe it hadn't reached a final judgment. And there was somewhat of an innuendo that maybe the First Amendment should not protect hateful, racist speakers, but at least the implication that the ACLU shouldn't necessarily continue to do that. And you can tell from my answers that I haven't read the letter recently, and I certainly don't know the signatories, but who the signatories were, and I wouldn't know them personally. But I have heard that they are disproportionately younger staff members, and that's the most important common characteristic. Certainly the leadership of the ACLU, the National Executive Director and Legal Director and President and National Board of Directors are solidly behind the traditional ACLU position, which goes back to the beginning of the organization. We're now almost 100 years old and very close to the founder. There was a debate about whether this new organization should defend freedom of speech for fascists in the 30s and 40s. And the ACLU then issued a manifesto explaining why it is incumbent on us to do that, that these are neutral principles that redound to the benefit of everybody or nobody, and that those who disproportionately are going to need it are those who lack political power, which will be people on the right in some communities at some times and people on the left in some communities at some times and on some issues. And there's always been pushback. And believe me, I, as the former head of an organization that prides itself on championing free speech, I'm not embarrassed about dissent or debate or discussion or reconsideration within the organization. That is to be welcomed. On this very issue, there were serious reexaminations at least two times within my adult lifetime. One was in the wake of the Skokie confrontation, which most people, you say Skokie, they know what it is. But let me just amplify for those who may not. In 1977, the ACLU came to the defense of the free speech rights of a group of neo-Nazis who wanted to demonstrate in Skokie, Illinois, a town near Chicago that had not only a very large Jewish population, but many of those Jewish citizens of Skokie were themselves Holocaust survivors. And when the ACLU successfully came to the defense of their free speech rights, we won in the courts of law easily because we were defending what the Supreme Court has called the bedrock principle of free speech jurisprudence, what lawyers usually call viewpoint neutrality or content neutrality. The government may never suppress speech because of disagreement or loathing, for that matter, of its viewpoint, content, or message, no matter how deeply despised it is by no matter how large a percentage of the population. So it was not controversial in the courts of law, but in the court of public opinion, including even ACLU members. It was, you know, these ACLU members defend all fundamental freedoms for all people equally. We're passionately committed to equality and anti-racism and against anti-Semitism and everything the fascists were spouting. So about 15% of ACLU members said, we defend freedom of speech, except the one exception we want to make is for Nazi speech. And about 15% of our members resigned. So and here, I don't hear any number, I don't hear reports of members resigning now, interestingly enough.
Oh, good. Okay. So that was sort of the precedent. Skokie was the precedent for Charlottesville. And we didn't mention this, that the letter we're discussing here came after the Charlottesville so-called alt-right march and, you know, subsequent protests, et cetera, last summer. And the letter was directly addressing that. But the larger issue, which you are saying, I think, is a foundational issue. It's a foundational question or a foundational answer to a particular question for the ACLU. It sounds to me like you're saying that if you don't take your stand on hate speech, you are essentially repudiating the founding mission of the organization. And therefore it becomes almost null.
It could become another, or I do see this as a core principle, the neutral defense of civil liberties. And when I was head of the ACLU, reporters would often ask me for a soundbite summary of what is the ACLU's central mission and what distinguishes it from the plethora of other organizations that have sprung up since the ACLU was founded. And I would say we are the only one that strives to defend all fundamental freedoms for all people, no matter who you are. No matter what you believe, you are equally entitled to certain basic rights. Now, you know, there are many ambiguities there. Some people consider the right to bear, well, this, and this relates directly to Charlottesville, the right to carry a gun, a firearm in public. They would consider that to be a fundamental freedom. I'm not sure that the ACLU would consider that to be a fundamental freedom.
Well, it hasn't.
But once we consider something to be a fundamental freedom, we have always neutrally defended it, including for those who reject our own civil liberties values. So we defend freedom of speech not only for fascists, you know, authoritarians and totalitarians on the left and the right, I might add. But even though we've been in the forefront of the movement for reproductive freedom, we have zealously defended freedom of speech for anti-abortion demonstrators outside abortion clinics. Even though we've been on the vanguard of the LGBT rights movement before there were specialized organizations defending those rights, we have defended the rights of those with other perspectives on the issue to air them. Here in New York City, we represented the Ancient Order of Hibernians, which privately sponsored a St. Patrick's Day parade, the big St. Patrick's Day parade, and were excluding from their parade, the Irish Lesbian and Gay Organization. And we would explain to our distraught friends in the gay community, look, when you have a gay pride parade, you're not going to be forced to allow the Ancient Order of Hibernians and others who oppose your rights in your parade.
So this book that you're writing is really very much an answer to, I think, what you see as a current movement, a new trend against that foundational principle. And what's happening here, as you see in these polls on campuses, at Oxford University Press, even within the ACLU itself, this feeling, I think is safe to say, a feeling that certain speech is harmful. Certain so-called hate speech, expressions of loathing, are harmful to people. And that is really, to me, what underlies this whole new argument or movement against what the ACLU has traditionally considered to be free speech. So let me tell you who is responsible for that movement.
Please do.
It's me.
Uh-oh, but yeah. I'm still going to defend your free speech, but let's hear it.
So until about the 1960s or 70s, almost everyone in this society believed that there was a clear separation, a clear distinction, a hard distinction between the real world and the world of ideas, between the physical world and what happens in our mind, between psychological injury and physical injury. There was a really clear difference. It was a bright line, and that's where the ACLU did its business. So it became very easy to be a free speech advocate or lawyer or ACLU activist, right?
And I think that in legal terms, what you're describing is often referred to as the distinction between speech and conduct, which I've always thought was oversimplified.
Right. So along comes a bunch of academics like me who start to teach their students that all power, all forms of power, are essentially discourse. It's all discursive power. And that some of it could be harmful, that is simply words traveling from your mind through your mouth into my ears and into my mind.
So were you pre-Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin or co-contemporaries of theirs? Because that's the same argument, right?
Well, it's a little, so here's, I'm somewhat joking, but I do think that the so-called postmodernist movement.
Yeah, no,
in academia,
I understand.
Yeah, I don't think they're postmodernist. So what I'm actually saying here is that postmodernism, as I understand it, meaning Foucault and mm-hmm. Derrida to some extent, to the extent that you can understand him, but certainly Foucault and others did not make this argument. It's not clear at all that they would be, in fact, I'm quite sure that Foucault would not be for hate speech laws, okay? It is true that I have been teaching as a Foucauldian at places like Columbia right down the street here for many years in that way, in that I do think everything's discursive, but I do also accept for the moment that I live in this particular world and that my values, even though they're social constructs, are still within this world and I still value them right now in this social construct of me as my identity, which is all a social construct, but it's just the one I'm choosing for the moment. Mm-hmm. And according to those values that I choose within this broader context, I like free speech as a principle and as a legal doctrine too.
Mm-hmm.
I might change my mind, but for my whole life, at least, I have wanted to live in a place where the government does not have anything to say about my speech or anyone else for that matter. So by the way, it's not just a legal doctrine. It's also a cultural doctrine. The mm-hmm. culture of free speech, I think, is just as important. In fact, I think it's more important.
I think so too.
And I would also say that I believe is Foucault's line that he would take if he were alive today. He was consistently against any sort of state intervention mm-hmm. against human beings of any kind, right? Mm-hmm. Against people, putting people in mental institutions and mm-hmm. prisons, mm-hmm. against all sorts of proscriptions against sexuality and, mm-hmm. and expressions mm-hmm. otherwise. So I think there's actually been a perversion of postmodernism that has accounted for this.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so I am sort of responsible, but actually I would say not at all, because I think that the students, if I have any former students who are calling for hate speech codes, and I'm sure I do, you weren't listening yeah. carefully, kids, in my classes.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have not been able to make my way through those philosophers, I admit, or even I find it hard to fully understand or find comprehensible the spin-off arguments that I have had to grapple with that have come from the anti-pornography, pro-censorship feminists such as MacKinnon and Dworkin, who certainly cite those works as supporting their theories about the lack of a bright line distinction between a description or a depiction of a rape and an actual rape.
Right.
MacKinnon actually says there literally is no distinction at all.
Right.
And that view has definitely been adopted lock, stock, and barrel on many college campuses by not only many students, but by many faculty members as well. That flap over the Feminist Philosophy Journal that happened a few months back, it's not necessary to get into the details, but the outpouring of vitriol against the feminist woman philosopher who was making some argument that somehow it was some connection between transgender and trans race, but it was attacked as literally violence. It was the attacks, and now I should be careful with my language, the verbal attacks, metaphorical attacks in that sense on her did not say you are doing harm that is similar in proportion to physical violence. They flat out said this is violence. Mm. Your ideas are an assault. Your words are directly harming.
You must be sympathetic to that on some level. I certainly am. I have been more wounded by words than I have by fists, right, in my life.
Absolutely.
I'm wounded almost every day, in fact. And it, boy, does it hurt.
It totally does.
And I would say there is speech that I have experienced that I would call violent.
Oh, well,
certainly.
I mean,
that's the legal distinction, right? But there, wouldn't you think? Do you think that there is such a thing as psychological violence?
You're deliberately inflicting pain and suffering.
Okay, so violence
through
your
words,
and this is a fine interpretation, but your definition is
well, what's yours
for that category? It's purely physical. Is that right?
Well, I guess there are physiological manifestations of psychological harm. I completely agree with that. So, Thad, thank you. You're helping me to clarify why I'm so what I disagree with that equation. I do think that words definitely cause pain and suffering, and I have read enough studies that indicate that there are actual physiological manifestations of the psychic trauma, if you will, whether it be, you know, wounds our pride or breaks our heart, or, you know, words hurt us in a zillion ways. A negative review of my book is going to be very painful to my psyche and probably cause me lost sleep, which will have adverse physiological impacts. But the critical distinction to my mind is the justification or lack thereof of government or official punishment.
Right.
I do believe that government is justified in protecting us against physical violence of the literal kind, and is not justified by and large, with a few carefully circumscribed exceptions, not justified in protecting us against hurt feelings. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to say that in a disparaging way, because I know, and by the way, I've been subject to hate speech. You won't be surprised. I've been subject to hate speech because of my views, but I do.
Well, I would imagine also because of your gender and probably because of your ethnicity.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember either whether this stayed in the book, which was brutally cut by an editor who thought people have short attention spans, but I certainly mentioned in my public speaking that for some reason I was not subject to anti-Semitic speech, at least of a vicious kind, until I was quite old. I was had graduated from law school and moved to New York from Minnesota. Well, they probably didn't even know what a Jew was in Minnesota.
Right.
No, I'm joking.
That's kind of true, actually. That's one of my side notes. I've I've always said that most people in middle America don't really know what Jews are. So it's not really a concern, anti-Semitism there.
Well, and the small band of Jews there call themselves the Frozen Chosen.
Right.
But anyway, I digress. So I was in New York. I had graduated from law school. I was practicing. I'd been practicing law for several years at a very prestigious Wall Street law firm. And I, in fact, was standing in line at a bank, as you had to do to get cash in those days, at a very fancy Wall Street building right next door to my law firm. And I was subject out of the blue to this nasty, horrible, anti-Semitic epithet, accompanied not with any physical violence at all, but, you know, glowering looks. And I was stupefied and tongue-tied. Mm. So I fully empathize with people who say, you know, there's free speech on both sides here. You can be silenced by hate speech, at least momentarily, as much as by government censorship. So I fully empathize with the pain and at least the momentary silencing. But I think that the vaunted solution of government outlawing and punishment is worse than the problem. The so-called cure is worse than the disease.
Right. So power is discursive. All power is discourse. That's why, what do they say? Words are violence or speech is violence?
Yeah.
What's the phrase? I forget. I saw
something
it actually
like
on a huge banner at Occidental College where I was teaching a couple years ago, right? But that's common, right, on campuses.
And in fact, similar to that at the College of William and Mary, where there was a demonstration against the ACLU speaker who was going to speak about students' free speech rights, including the right to protest, one of their signs said, liberalism is white supremacy.
Yeah, that was William and Mary, yeah.
William and Mary, did I say it wrong? I'm sorry.
No,
William and Mary. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, they're leaving out a few other connectors there, but basically a liberal defense of freedom of speech is enacting white supremacy, subjugating non-white people.
So I don't think they're wrong in saying that. I think that you can feel whatever you want about words.
Oh.
And you can, and I think your interpretation of that feeling is utterly legitimate. It's not any more or less real or legitimate than any other interpretation of those feelings. I'm not going to say to someone, a Jewish woman in a bank in New York City having some epithet hurled at her, I'm not going to say to her, oh, that's really nothing, or it's not as important or not as painful to you as if I punched you in the face. I'm not going to tell you that because that is entirely up to you, right? And I don't think we want to be in the business of doing that. And
I completely agree.
And I do think that many people on our side of this question do that too often.
I agree.
In fact, I think that's the sort of default response to the pro hate speech code movement.
I completely agree with that. And in the acknowledgments in my book, I thank the law professors who back in the 80s were the ones that first started writing about the problem of hate speech on college campuses and advocating for hate speech codes. I don't thank them for their proposed solution. I disagree with that, but they made a very major contribution in spelling out the enormous harm that can be done by words.
So this is what I've said to my students over the last 20-some years teaching on those very campuses. I've said that if you want to feel like any word is violence, that is completely legitimate. But what if you call for reifying, making real in law, in state power, your interpretation of your feelings, then I oppose you. Then that what you're doing, and I think this is what Foucault argues, in fact, and most real postmodernists argue, is that power comes from below just as much as it comes from above, and that the people can create a new form of power through discourse by demanding something like protection by the state against the bad guys. And so that this would be, I think, in the postmodernist way of thinking about things, what's going on is people are calling for a new form of power, a new form of state power, adding to this power, which you could also call a repressive power,
right,
or an oppressive power,
right,
because once we have a state with this new weapon, this new,
right,
apparatus to control us, and Foucault,
right,
was really interested in what he called biopower, the control of people,
mm-hmm,
then I don't see how being for hate speech codes or laws is consistent at all with that line of leftist postmodernist thinking. Renegade University and School Sucks Project are teaming up once again for another weekend with Thaddeus Russell, this time in the baddest, most renegade city of them all, New Orleans, Louisiana. Between May 11th and May 13th, we'll be meeting right in the heart of New Orleans, where jazz was created, where the American Mafia was created, where the first red light district in the United States was established, and where Little Richard began his career as a drag queen. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the history of race in the United States and the history of American popular culture, including jazz and blues and rock and roll, and its effects across the world over the last 200 years. We'll also be doing a live recording of the unregistered first anniversary episode. For more information and to buy tickets to A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell in New Orleans, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses.
This may be a little bit to the side, but you made me, when you were discussing reifying your own feelings,
mm-hmm,
right, by empowering the state, to me it seemed very analogous to anti-abortion advocates who have this deep feeling that what they call the preborn child is a person,
yep,
and that abortion is murder. And
yep,
I also respect those feelings and those beliefs.
Yep.
I
exactly
engage in those debates and because I respect them, but I part company at
mm-hmm
the point where they want government
mm-hmm
to be able to criminalize
exactly
those who have a different belief.
Right. Yeah. I say to them, prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Prove that it's murder. And they
mm-hmm
can't, of course. Prove that the slaughter of cattle is murder.
Mm-hmm.
They can't prove it. They can't show me the consciousness of a cow. They can't show me the consciousness of a fetus. And so they can't also prove objectively that saying the N-word
mm-hmm
is equivalent to physical violence.
By the way, on a number of campuses, defending and advocating what they call a pro-life position has been castigated as hate speech, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the other problems with this concept is that it is used to attempt to stifle very important political messages. I mean, I've already mentioned the criminal justice issues and the Black Lives Matter issue, abortion, people wearing a Trump paraphernalia or, you know, a cap or a T-shirt or painting the word Trump on a sidewalk. That's
right.
Been denounced as hate speech and
right.
hate crimes.
At Occidental, that was the first place it happened. There was someone took chalk and just, I think, wrote the words Trump or something, or build
right.
the wall and,
right.
and the campus and people. That was a hate speech.
So please,
act of violence, yeah.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to underscore. I completely defend people's freedom to express their views,
mm-hmm.
including those posters at William & Mary, even though I disagree with them. But I part company when they either invoke state power to suppress other
mm-hmm.
views or through violence or shouting down, prevent the other views from being aired.
Right. Yeah. So I'm going to stop using his name eventually, but you know, Foucault argues that what would happen there is that it wouldn't just be invoking state power. It would be creating a new state power,
yes.
a new power put out there. That would be both a set of new ideas,
yes.
right? That hate speech laws are legitimate and necessary, but
yes.
it would also create reified
yes.
power in the form of guns and cops and prisons.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. And people in cages. Yes.
What's so interesting about all of this that, I mean, there are many interesting dimensions, but one is that in the other Western democracies,
mm-hmm.
modern democracies
yes.
that all have hate speech laws, all the Western European countries do, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and they have had for 20 or 30 years now. Interestingly enough, the liberals and the progressives and the human rights lawyers and activists are changing their opinions now that they've seen how the laws have actually operated.
Oh, are they? I didn't know.
And
this.
There is a whole chorus of them from so many different countries, and including from the UN and other international agencies, which had been very gung-ho on hate speech laws several decades ago. Now they see how they are operating, and they're saying either we should get rid of them altogether, or we should not enforce them, or we definitely have to bolster them with that counter speech, the engagement of civic society. Which is civil society, which is what happens in this country, or we should radically revise the laws so that they only punish speech that is punishable consistent with American jurisprudence, you know, a clear and present danger emergency kind of concept. So, and Glenn Greenwald, hardly a conservative, wrote quite soon after Charlottesville, when there was a resurgence among liberals and civil rights activists, or maybe we should outlaw hate speech in this country. He wrote a wonderful couple of essays in The Guardian, and one of them was essentially, be careful what you wish for. Mm-hmm. You imagine that all the speech that you hate is what is going to be suppressed, and it's true. In Europe, there has been punishment of anti-immigrant and anti-refugee and anti-Muslim speech and so forth, but there also has been a lot of suppression of criticism of Israel, criticism of homophobia, and he lists a whole lot of examples, which I have in my book too, of speech that is dear to liberals that they would never imagine that somebody else could consider hate speech and hateful. You know, Germany just started enforcing its hate speech law on the internet in full force on January 1st of 2018. And yes, the very first people who were censored on the law were leaders of the far-right Alternative for Deutschland party, white supremacist agenda. But hot on the heels of that, a progressive satirical magazine that was satirizing the AfD speakers was itself censored for hate speech.
Of course. Yeah, because I think I'm guessing that within Western European ideological discourse that those things were considered to be clear and present dangers. Right?
Yes.
To the
yes.
political regimes there. Now, clear and present danger. I want to talk about that because you have an ancestor who was a clear and present danger. Can you talk about your grandfather? Who was your, I think, was it your mother's father?
My maternal grandfather, Anton Simicic, who had come to this country from what was then Croatia in the early part of the 20th century. And he was a confirmed Marxist. I have one of my mother's brothers was named Marxism. People didn't.
The name was Marxism?
His name was Marxism. Everybody called him Max, but his real name was Marxism. Wow. And my uncle Lenny, you can guess what his real name was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Leonid for...
for Lenin. His real name was Lenin.
I mean, sorry, I was thinking of Brezhnev. Sorry, yes.
L-E-N-I-N. Right.
I was thinking Vladimir. Yeah, yeah, whatever. Yeah,
so
yeah.
He was a confirmed Marxist and pacifist and absolutely opposed the United States entry into and fighting in World War I. And it's so, I get chills every time I think about this because his granddaughter became the national leader of the organization that was founded precisely to and most immediately to defend rights of people like him. The ACLU sprouted out of an earlier organization that was formed in 1918 called the Civil Liberties Bureau of the American Union Against Militarism. So the Civil Liberties Bureau was defending the free speech rights and other constitutional rights of conscientious objectors. But they weren't able to help my grandfather, who was sentenced, and his punishment was to stand outside the courthouse, the Hudson County Courthouse in New Jersey, spread-eagled, his hands and his legs facing the wall, so that passersby could spit on him.
He violated the Espionage Act, right, of 1917.
Yes, yes.
Which made it unlawful to disrupt or block any military activities during a time of war, right?
Yes.
And the court upheld that.
And upheld it, shockingly, in opinions that were joined by Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Who not just joined, he wrote the very famous
exactly.
Clear and Present Danger. And so a lot of people don't know this. This was the Schenck decision of 1919.
And he goes on later on in the same year to completely recast. I mean, he doesn't repudiate. He purports to be simply reapplying the same concept in a completely different way.
So everyone knows this, right? Every schoolboy and schoolgirl in the United States has been taught this at some point. Holmes, the great progressive jurist, wrote this in the Schenck case. The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man falsely, very important word,
exactly.
That's often left out,
usually
falsely
left out.
Shouting fire mm-hmm. in a theater and causing a panic. This is about Charles Schenck, who was mm-hmm. just like your grandfather, mm-hmm. was convicted of violating the Espionage Act because he was simply opposing mm-hmm. the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And the question, Holmes says, the question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. So substantive evils in this case, and for the last 100 years, mm-hmm. has been actually opposition to war. Because yeah. guess what act is still on the books? The Espionage
Act of 1917.
Shockingly.
Now, once something is on the books, it's very hard to get rid of it. And it lies around like a loaded weapon that could be invoked again. In my book, I choose not to use the phrase clear and present danger. I use it historically to explain that it was invoked by the Supreme Court. And again, during the Cold War, McCarthyism panic, when people who were merely teaching works by my uncle's namesakes, Marx mm-hmm. and Lenin, were found guilty under these laws. And on the theory that, well, even if the danger is not present, if it's clear and it would be so great, we can discount the likelihood by the magnitude of the harm. So basically it became a very malleable phrase that was used to punish, could be used to punish any critic of government policy. And when you invoke war or national security, there's more zeal to punish critics of the policy. So what Holmes later endorsed, along with Justice Louis Brandeis in dissenting opinions, starting later in 1919 in the famous Abrams mm-hmm. case, and was adopted by the majority unanimously in 1969 in an ACLU case, interestingly,
Brandenburg.
Involving mm-hmm. free speech for Ku Klux Klan demonstrators, mm-hmm. interestingly enough. The court really reined in the concept and used the term emergency, and I like that better. The court specifically said there has to be a specific, imminent danger that the speech causes, objectively demonstrable, right? And it's a very, very hard test to satisfy. Mm-hmm. And I can, you know, there's no way that those dissident anti-war speakers would have satisfied that standard. You know, one of the most shocking examples, the same year as the Schenck case, involved Eugene Debs, mm-hmm. a socialist party leader, candidate for president. I think he got something like 6% mm-hmm. of the...
A million votes.
I mean, it was much higher percentage than any third party candidate in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. Ralph Nader got a mere pittance, too much, but I'm sorry, editorial comment. And he was very circumspect because he knew that federal agents were trailing him, just waiting for him to say something that they could prosecute him for. And so he actually says, and the Supreme Court recounts this in this decision, I'm not saying to you everything that I think, but I will tell you that you are fit for more than cannon fodder. And so basically he was prosecuted and convicted. Mm-hmm. His sentence was it 10 years? It was 10-year sentence.
I forget the exact term, but he spent several years in the Terre Haute Penitentiary.
He was ultimately, his sentence was he wasn't pardoned, mm-hmm. but he was released early. He
right.
wasn't so semi-pardoned, whatever the legal term is for that. You can tell I'm not a criminal lawyer. And he was in effect then punished for a thought crime because he didn't say anything explicitly mm-hmm. opposing the war, just suggesting that you can read between the lines. I'm not saying everything on that, I think.
Well, Debs was pretty clearly anti-war.
Yeah.
And he was directly advocating or telling young men not to join the military.
The speech that he was convicted for, he did certainly did not.
But it
say
was well.
That.
But it was well known that that was his position.
But that's what I'm saying. So they're punishing him for what he.
Well,
had.
But Schenck actually did directly, right?
Yeah,
that's not debated.
Yeah.
That he was saying, he was telling young men. I think he was handing out leaflets in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. saying, "Young men, don't join the army for this imperialist war in Europe." So Debs was, as you said, the leader of the Socialist Party, which is essentially a revolutionary mm-hmm. movement or organization. Mm-hmm. They were calling for a radical revolution, you know, mm-hmm. Overthrow of capitalism in the United States mm-hmm. and the government that, you know, propped up capitalism. Mm-hmm. He was nonetheless put in prison, not for the socialism, mm-hmm. not for the revolution, mm-hmm. but for simply being anti-war, as mm-hmm. was Schenck.
Mm-hmm.
And then in subsequent Supreme Court decisions following the Smith Act in 1940, mm-hmm. right, which basically made revolutionary sedition illegal.
And that was where the Communist Party leaders were convicted, as I mentioned
right,
earlier.
A couple hundred Communist Party members were convicted and did time in prison during World War II mm-hmm. for really being revolutionaries. And mm-hmm. so the Supreme Court for a while actually said it was constitutional mm-hmm. for governments to put in prison mm-hmm. people who were revolutionaries. Now, that was overturned, right? Eventually, the Supreme Court narrowed that to the point where it's almost non-existent.
Exactly. And all
however,
of the... However... Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
No, yeah, no, sorry.
Go,
this,
go ahead, yeah.
These decisions we're talking about are the Dennis decision mm-hmm. in 51 mm-hmm. and the Yates decision in 57, which mm-hmm. narrowed the definition, essentially, of sedition.
Mm-hmm.
And meaning that more and more revolutionary seditious speech became protected by the First Amendment according to the court. Okay, so one of the interesting things, though, is that in the Yates decision in 57, the court said that part of the reason it was making this ruling allowing more seditious speech was that seditious speech was becoming few and far between.
Yeah.
And I think this is crucial.
It is.
I think it's all contextual and historically contingent. 1957, of course, this is before the civil rights movement really is a national phenomenon. This is when there is a lot of conformity, cultural conformity, the height of the Red Scare. There's not really a large left-wing or revolutionary presence in American politics. The Socialist Party had basically died out. The Communist Party had effectively died out by then. And so it was easy for the government to say this, that, well, yeah, we'll allow people to be revolutionaries in their speech because it's not really a threat to us anymore. Whereas during the time of Eugene Debs and the time of the Smith Act in 1940, this SP and the CP mm-hmm. were large mm-hmm. mass mobilization organizations mm-hmm. with millions of members and mm-hmm. fellow travelers.
And in 1919, there was a lot of social unrest and violence, right? Bombs planted around the country and even delivered. One was delivered to the home of Oliver Wendell Holmes, no less, as
right.
I recall, and other government leaders.
So it's basically protected for me to call for a revolution mm-hmm. in this country now, and has been since about 57. But one thing remains unprotected, which is my right to say, or my ability to say to soldiers mm-hmm. or potential soldiers, don't sign up, don't join the military, don't go to war. Because in 1967, George Daniels, you may disagree with me, but George Daniels and William Harvey were two black, I think they were Marines. They were in the mm-hmm. Navy. I think they might have been Marines, mm-hmm. but they were in the service during mm-hmm. the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And they held a meeting mm-hmm. of fellow service members, black service members, mm-hmm. and said, this is the white man's war.
Mm-hmm.
This is not our war. We have no quarrel with the Vietnamese. It's not clear exactly what they called for, but they were basically saying to service members, to soldiers, don't participate.
But that was before Brandenburg.
It was 2 years before Brandenburg. But George Daniels and William Harvey were sentenced to hard labor.
Wow.
And there was no No one, that don't, it never reached the Supreme Court, yeah. and they did their time. Yeah.
That would clearly be unconstitutional now to punish them.
Well, is that true?
I'm absolutely convinced of that. And it's very, and if, first of all, that didn't reach the Supreme Court, which is significant. The Supreme Court, for better or worse, doesn't correct all erroneous lower court decisions. Secondly, that was exactly on the cusp of a revolution on the Supreme Court itself, which came about partly in response to Vietnam, but mostly in response to the civil rights movement. And I think anti-war movement was a kind of an, you're the historian, I'm only reading it through the lens of Supreme Court decisions. But my interpretation would be that the Supreme Court's desire to protect the civil rights movement, which was being suppressed in every possible way, including free speech being suppressed and protests being suppressed, that everybody else, including anti-war demonstrators, were the incidental beneficiaries. So this, if you, many, many cases, the great free speech cases of the 1960s and 1970s arose from the civil rights movement. And Harry Calvin, who was a professor at the University of Chicago and very strong free speech advocate and activist, wrote a book in, I think it came out in the early 70s, and he used the term that was accepted at the time, that was the polite term at the time, the Negro and the First Amendment. And one of his trenchant lines that explained why the case law had changed was, he said, the Negroes won back for us the rights that the communists had lost for us. Somebody else said that the blacks won the rights that the reds had lost.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And
that's fantastic.
It's so interesting yeah. because when you were talking earlier about on a different subject before we got on the podcast, but it relates to my book. I read recently why the bifurcation between the term civil liberties and the term civil rights, which is very much at the heart of the debate that we've been discussing, what seems to be a perennial debate. Can you advocate for equality and non-discrimination and social justice for various groups of people that have been subject to discrimination, and also advocate for the way we now use the term civil liberties, freedom of speech, privacy, due process, and so forth. And according to this article, and I don't know how respected or authoritative it is, I haven't checked the sources. Nowadays, you have to say that. But on its face, it seemed very persuasive and well documented, argued that it was in the 40s and 50s in reaction to anti-communism that and the term civil liberties was very much associated with communists who were advocating against the national security state and for individual liberty. And so the civil rights movement, to make itself more appealing to middle America, started embracing the term civil rights in contradistinction to civil liberties.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I'll give you the citation.
Yeah, I believe you. It makes sense. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah. But nowadays, at the Brandenburg decision, since you and I have referred to it a couple of times, that was in 1969, the Supreme Court said you can, you know, when can you punish speech that might induce violence or some other harmful act? You can, and in the past, the court had used, including in the old cases we've been talking about, what is usually called the bad tendency test. If speech has a tendency to instill a bad idea, which might down the road lead to a bad action, that's enough to justify punishing it, which is why Schenck and Debs and Margaret Sanger and civil rights activists, and including the anti-war activists that you mentioned in 1967, were all jailed under this bad tendency test. And the Supreme Court really tightened it up in Brandenburg and said, you can only be punished for speech that might induce unlawful or other harmful conduct if, but only if, the speaker intends to incite imminent violence or lawlessness, and it is likely that the violence or lawlessness will actually happen imminently. And the court has enforced that rigorously, including against anti-war demonstrators and activists who have used very incendiary language.
I'm not convinced because the Espionage Act, as you agreed, is still on the books.
Yeah.
And it's,
and I think if enforced in those cases, it would be found unconstitutional as applied, at least.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your optimism, but I think that in every case, when there was a war, and in particular when there was a draft, meaning that a war in which there was the need for massive manpower, that the court has not been on our side on this.
Well, it's true that other doctrines, you're making a fair point. Other doctrines have emerged that have made exceptions, if you will, to the strong emergency principle. So thinking aloud, during the Vietnam War, you know, over very strong and persuasive dissents. I mean, that's important to note. A 5-4 case, these in 1969, I believe, also, but right around there, the court upheld government's power to criminalize burning of draft cards, which was, of course, a major way of expressing protest against the Vietnam War. And it created, to me, this pretextual explanation that it wasn't the idea that was conveyed by burning the draft card that was being punished. So see, the court felt it necessary to distance itself from the old bad tendency rationale. It said, no, this is a horse of a different color. We are protecting the administrative apparatus that is necessary to enforce the draft, that you, if you have people physically destroying the draft cards, we can't mobilize them fast enough.
Exactly.
So that, it was totally pretextual. You know, I'm certainly a bit harsh critic. And more recently, let's bring it up to date. I think that, you know, the current Supreme Court, across the spectrum from left to right, as broad as that spectrum is, has been on the whole remarkably good in protecting the most controversial speech. But one black spot, and it was a case that was argued by the ACLU's now legal director, David Cole, before he became our legal director, the court upheld this an outlawing of material support for terrorism, because terrorism has become the communism our day, and defined the concept material support with breathtaking broadness, so that it was even providing humanitarian support or education to organizations that have been labeled by the U.S. government, by the State Department, to be terrorist organizations. And as we pointed out in opposing the law, you know, Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress would have been terrorists under under that definition. And even if you were providing, you know, food, you would violate the law. So I take your point. It's fair that we have to, the true test of our principles is when they do seem to pose a real risk that there could be real harm to real people. And we saw after 9/11, public opinion polls showed that just about everybody was willing to give up all kinds of freedoms, especially if they were other people's freedoms, like, you know, dark-skinned immigrants of a certain religion from a certain part of the world. But even their own, I think, in fairness.
I just find it striking that foreign policy really guides the real core principle here all the way through the 20th and 21st century, right? It's, it's we can't allow our foreign policy objectives to be interfered with,
And I think
even by speech. Right? Everything else you can talk about, socialism, and communism, and anarchism, and revolution, and all that. But when it comes to burning your draft card, or simply saying, boys, don't go to war, no, we will put you in prison.
I think James Madison said it so well, and I can't even remember, you know, people should look it up. But basically, the idea was that war and for other foreign policy is always going to be the excuse that it has the most power to suppress civil liberties here.
I also find it striking that World War One, the Espionage Act, was that was a passed that was signed into law by Woodrow Wilson, great progressive president. The Smith Act was signed into law by Franklin Roosevelt, great progressive president.
And let's not forget the executive order that Franklin Roosevelt signed for interning Japanese Americans.
Right, that's the one crime against humanity that people do seem to know about Roosevelt, but they forget all the others, which I think are actually in some ways even greater, if that's possible. But and then, of course, the whole history of the Cold War, I mean, it begins with Truman. People think of it as a Republican thing somehow, but it's absolutely, you know, the Truman Initiative in many ways, but suppressions of speech during that era, Eisenhower was a part of it as well. But then we have Vietnam, right? And so 67, George Daniels and I forget his other name, but the two black servicemen who were put in military prison for simply saying this is a white man's war, that was under the Johnson administration.
Yeah. But, you know, the Supreme Court had a case, later than 1967, involving an African-American man who was meeting with a group of others, interestingly enough, as part of a protest or organization in Washington, D.C., against police brutality and police abuses against African-American men. How things change, huh? And they were also talking about the draft. And he said, if they ever put a gun in my hands, the first person I'm going to get in my sight is LBJ, referring to Lyndon Baines Johnson. Mm-hmm. I am not going to kill my dark-skinned brothers. And he was convicted of threatening the president. He faced a 5-year sentence, surprisingly low when you think of how sentences have escalated since then, another story. But the Supreme Court overturned that and said, you know, that's political hyperbole. It was not posing a clear and present danger. Right. It doesn't meet
the emergency. So threatening to kill the president is even considered to be less important, less of a clear and present danger than simply saying, this is a white man's war, don't serve it.
But that was not a Supreme Court decision. So, you know, we can discuss it. I think that the Supreme Court, you know, even at that time, but certainly now, would not allow punishment.
Okay, so let's bring it back to the ACLU and the current politics of it. So Anthony Romero is the president, has been
executive director.
Executive director.
The president
director.
Is like the chair of the board and the executive director.
He really
the day-to-day
runs.
Running it.
Okay, so he's been executive director for what?
Since 2001. He came into office 6 days after 9/11.
Okay. So I think, right, that's right. I could have misread this, but I thought I saw a news report in recent months in which it sounded to me like he was calling for the ACLU to put a lot of its resources toward simply electing Democrats. Does that sound like...
I'm sorry, Anthony, I can't read everything that you write or everything that you're quoted as saying or misquoted as saying, but that would completely violate the ACLU by its principles and its corporate charter is nonpartisan.
I don't think he came out and said it quite that explicitly, but boy, I sure read it that way. And I think it also followed right on this letter about Charlottesville and how the ACLU, a significant portion of the organization, is reconsidering its commitment to the protection of hate speech. So,
well, I would have to tell you, it would completely transgress the not only the founding principles, but actually a very dominant, effective strategy of the ACLU. Because when you were praising me for working with everybody, that's the ACLU's philosophy. We will never oppose or endorse anybody for office, appointed or elected. We will criticize or praise on an issue-by-issue basis, and for a number of reasons, one of which is principled, but one of which is completely pragmatic. You know, you're not going to be able to effectively persuade people if you've campaigned against them.
Well, you may have noticed, though, in the last year or so, that a lot of people who are ordinarily quite intelligent and principled and consistent in their thinking on politics have looked not so rational all the time and have looked quite partisan or more partisan than ever. And I think that what I'm seeing, my guess is that what's happening within the ACLU is part of this Trump, anti-Trump hysteria. And I fear greatly.
I would be very surprised. Let me just say this. The ACLU was criticized so much by supporters of Obama, by supporters of Bill Clinton, because we were so hard on particular policies of them, too.
Sure.
Let me tell you, very soon after Obama was elected, when to everybody's horror and disappointment, because it was contrary to, and believe me, there were many things he did that were pro-civil liberties. I mean, just about everybody has a mixed record. But it was horrifying that he was perpetuating George W. Bush's policies in the so-called anti-terrorism policies, including mass surveillance mm-hmm. without any probable cause and maintaining Guantanamo despite promises to close it and so forth, the drone attacks, which were without any due process. And we took out, you know, months after he had taken office, an ad in the New York Times that in four frames showed, and I know it was for Martin Luther King Day, it showed George W. Bush's face morphing into Obama's face mm-hmm. in four frames. It was very dramatic and pointed out that surveillance that Obama was reauthorizing was exactly what had been used against Martin Luther King. So I just can't, it's not in the ACLU's DNA to become a partisan organization.
Hmm.
I'm not here to defend what the ACLU is doing now. I don't know everything the ACLU is doing now. And even when I was very active, all of us dissented from certain things that were done. But that would be a fundamental transform. So what I can answer is, if that is in fact happening covertly as well as overtly, that would... transform sounds like too positive a word, would mm-hmm. gut the heart and soul of what the ACLU is about. I mean, we have plenty of organizations in this country that are advocates for particular ideologies, substantively for particular candidates or political parties. And that is not what this organization's mission is.
Well, let me tell you what Politico reported on January 8th of this mm-hmm. year. So it says, "The American Civil Liberties Union, rarely an active player in national campaigns, is jumping into the 2018 midterms with plans to spend upward of $25 million promoting ballot initiatives and issues in contested races across the country." Now, that can be read in many ways. It then goes on to say, this is quoting Anthony Romero, the executive director. This is a quote from him. "It's clear that a larger portion of the American public is deeply engaged in politics in a way they've never been before." And then it says, most of the ACLU spending in 2018, this is the Politico talking, okay? Not Romero, but it's reporting this. "Most of the ACLU spending in 2018 will be directed at Republicans, though operatives haven't ruled out indirectly going after Democrats on the wrong side of their issues, too. It will not form a PAC or endorse candidates, moves that would mean losing its 501c4 nonprofit status, instead limiting its activity to promoting issues and initiatives." And then it goes on to list. Among them are voting rights, the travel ban, disability rights, reproductive rights, and immigration. Now,
I read between
the lines here, that sure sounds to me like they are likely to pretty, not explicitly, but directly go after Republicans with the mission of really of getting rid of Trump. Is an anti-Trump. I could be wrong.
That's not the way I hear it at all, which is, and thank you for clarifying that you were, when you were quoting from Politico and not the ACLU. And I'm saying this not at all defensively. I certainly have been a critic when I think the organization has done something wrong. But I hear that as doing what we've always done, which is speaking on issues. And as I said earlier, critiquing or praising candidates or officials on an issue by issue basis. Mm. And it could well be that on the issues that you list is predominantly Republicans that are taking anti-civil liberties positions. But take another issue, freedom of speech on campus. If it turns out that it's predominantly Democrats that are taking anti-civil liberties positions on that issue, then we would be critiquing mostly Democrats. So that's the way I process that. And I think Politico is looking at it through a political lens, and maybe that's real politique, and I'm naive to think that the world is going to view this anything as anything other than political. And I have to, you know, that's something else that has been of concern to the ACLU, in that we have always avoided not only overtly endorsing or opposing candidates, but also actions that could be perceived that way. And from what you say, there's at least a perception problem here. So I take your point and thank you for raising my concern.
Yeah, I'm just curious. I know that you're not actively involved in the day-to-day operations and don't know the sort of younger staff in particular. Yeah. And I think that's probably what's going on. It's generational. It's the people who were taught by professors like me, as I mentioned already, right, who are the problem here, unfortunately. But I am concerned about it because this is, of course, just a few months after the letter.
Yeah, I'm concerned too. And because I think... precisely because of what's happening on the national and nationwide political scene, I think it's incredibly important that we have individuals and organizations that are seen as somehow being able to rise above the fray on at least some core issues.
When the letter came out, were you talking with colleagues who were, you know, of the older generation, ACLU people, with your position on this? It must have been, I imagine.
Well, but including Anthony and David, you know, the two top leaders.
Anthony Romero did not like this.
Absolutely not. And he and David, the National Legal Director, were criticized very strongly by the letter is addressed to them in protest. And when David publicly defended the ACLU's classic position, I thought eloquently in the New York Review, he was then subject to another wave of criticism internally. Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, there is a process going on to re-examine whether the ACLU should continue its classic position. And I am not at all opposed to re-examination. How could I be? You know, maybe we should become a different organization. Maybe times have changed that would warrant. Nothing is beyond debate. That's exactly what my whole book is about. There is no idea that should be off the table. Mm-hmm. Even the most radical idea that the ACLU, as I've known and loved it, should go out of existence and a new organization or, you know, with a different name or even the same name. Of course, it's legitimate to debate that. And I was starting to tell you, it's not at all the first time that we've had these debates. The most recent time on this particular issue was in around 1990 to 91, and the debate started earlier, probably in the late 80s, when we saw the advent of the movement for so-called hate speech codes on college campuses. And there it was a different argument than had been made to justify suppressing hate speech in the past, which was more a concern about potential violence or fascists gaining political power, as we discussed earlier. And as we also discussed earlier, the proponents of hate speech codes were a group of minority law professors, African American, Asian American, who made very powerful arguments about how, in fact, the classic first article in this group by Richard Delgado, Latino, was Words That Wound. Mm-hmm. And they really powerfully talked about not only the adverse psychic and emotional impact with accompanying physiological manifestations, speech suppressing, and disenfranchisement. So, you know, this was the beginning of the real integration of institutions of higher education, and the ACLU had been on the forefront of advocating for that. And so it was a very powerful argument that, of course, we had to entertain. It's not enough in terms of equal protection principles to open the doors, to lower the barriers, but then subject people to this, you know, demeaning barrage of incapacitating speech that is denying them any meaningful equality. Of course, we had to grapple with that.
To me, it's a breathtakingly contradictory politics. So on the one hand, they are arguing persuasively to me that Columbia University, Harvard University, were established by white supremacists to serve the interests of the ruling class of the United States, and that they haven't ever really fundamentally changed, that they still serve the interests of the ruling class, which is predominantly white and still upholds the values and the ideology that were really established by the old white men who we hate so much. dead old white men. So I agree with that. On the other hand, what they are calling for is giving more power to the heads of those very institutions to police, regulate, and banish ideas. Ideas, not just speech, ideas from those places. It's a really, I'm no longer depressed about it because it's just, I've gotten over it. I've done a lot of therapy and I've let it go, but it's quite a thing. And I am really worried about something. So back to the ACLU.
But can I just finish the thought that you and I were exchanging? Because it's a very powerful point. And that's where I part company with those advocates. And that's what happened within the ACLU. So we had a committee that studied the issue, and there was a lot of controversy. The Wall Street Journal and others more on the right end of the spectrum said, see, the ACLU is just another liberal organization. They really don't care about civil liberties. How dare they re-examine their classic position? And lo and behold, the National Board unanimously reaffirmed the position, which never happens. We have a board of more than 80 members. Wow. Rarely, almost never is there unanimity. And the policy rationale that supported maintaining the classic position did acknowledge that there could be harm from speech, but that it would be even more harmful to empower officials to punish it. And instead, I mean, it was like a template for my book. It's basically the same message. We listed like a dozen or more strategies consistent with free speech that would counter the adverse impact of hateful speech and hateful ideas, steps that we endorsed, including multicultural education, which was a new phenomenon on back then, you know, vigorous affirmative action, training of teachers, cultural centers for minority groups, you know, the whole panoply that I read has still not been enacted on many college campuses. So, you know, it's a very similar dichotomy to what I explore in my book. Yes, we accept that words are powerful and to do a lot of good and also a lot of harm. And that's why we defend words, because they are so powerful. Right. But we may agree that there's a problem there, but we radically disagree with a proposed solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that dichotomy, I think it's a social construct, but it's a social construct I like. So I love that decision that the ACLU made. When was that, though?
So that policy was adopted in around 1991. I believe I was already president, maybe 1990.
That's when I moved to this neighborhood. That was my first year at Columbia. So times are changing, Nadine.
And everybody says that. And they say, is Charlottesville is different from Skokie?
So this is my worry. Times are changing in a few ways. And I think that one of the things we're going to see, I think it's very likely that the Democrats will take power again in the White House, maybe not in the next election, but sometime in the not too distant future. And it's pretty clear that they want two things. They want, on the one hand, hate speech law. They want to do this. I mean, this is, Democrats have pretty clearly veered toward identity politics in recent years, following again on these, I think, really movements that emerged in college campuses because of professors like me. But that's pretty clear. So I think that's almost a consensus opinion among Democrats.
I'm
pretty close.
I'm not sure about that.
Among younger Democrats, it certainly is.
Oh, that's interesting, because I testified before two committees on this issue, one of the in the Senate and one in the House, and there was bipartisan support for free speech.
Those are old people.
I was going to say Eleanor Holmes Norton was on one of the committees, and Patty Murray was the ranking member.
I think
member.
The 20-somethings and the 30-something Democrats are almost, it's almost a consensus among them that we should have some.
Then they're going to have to read my
restrictions
book.
On. Yeah, well, that's why your book will be so important.
You.
But that's one thing that I think they're going to impose. They're going to try to put into law. They're going to go more European, I think, in terms of hate speech.
And it's so ironic, as Europe wants to go more American.
Right. I didn't know that, but that's interesting. But and then the second thing they pretty clearly want is an expansion of NATO around Russia. They want to strengthen NATO. They want to be more aggressive toward Russia. I'm not saying that we will have a world war or a war with Russia when a Democrat takes power, but I think that they are very likely to push us further in that direction. And so you combine those two tendencies within the Democratic Party, which will almost certainly control the federal government within the next 4 to 8 years. I am very terrified that we're going to be in another situation that looks a lot like what put your grandfather in prison, and maybe even worse. And so I think now is the time, more than ever, to take the position you're taking. I also think it's important to take a foreign policy position that takes away their rationale for restricting speech, like opposition to war. But it's all coming together, right? I see those two historical tendencies coming together again right now or soon. And I'm really worried about that, especially because I am not as convinced as you that the ACLU will maintain the position that you have. I think you're an older generation that unfortunately is fading away or dying out. And I just see a different thing happening.
And whether you're right or wrong about the ACLU or the Democrats, clearly we who support certain principles have, whether we are doing it in our capacity as educators or media stars or authors or advocates, we have to provide community or cultural support for free speech. And we've seen that over and over again. And I think you intimated that when you were suggesting that the Supreme Court has only willingly supported free speech when the culture has shifted.
Right.
So there's no longer the moral panic mm-hmm. and terror about the dangers of communism or, for that matter, terrorism, mm-hmm. as the Supreme Court waited quite a while after 9/11 before it started taking cases that were challenging overreaches in the war on terror. And there, many people have made this point far more eloquently than I have, probably most eloquently. Learned Hand, in his famous Spirit, a judge, great judge on the Second Circuit, in his Spirit of Liberty speech during World War II, said liberty has to live or die in the hearts of men or women. He actually said men, but I'm paraphrasing. If it lives there, it needs no constitution, no law, no court to save it. If it does not live there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. Similarly, Zechariah Chafee, part of the politically powerful Chafee family, who was a professor at Harvard Law School in the early 20th century and one of the founders of the ACLU, one of the early great free speech scholars in the United States, said, so he was a legal scholar, a constitutional law scholar, but to me, one of the most prescient statements he made was, in the long run, people will have as much free speech as they want.
Exactly. Power comes from below.
So we really have to persuade these young people that they need free speech and the causes they hold dear require free speech.
The culture of freedom, the culture of free speech is more important, I think, more powerful than the legal doctrine of free speech or freedom. And I think that's what you're saying. I agree with you.
That's why I took a leave from teaching at law school for an entire year and a half so I could be a full-time advocate and educator in the more general community.
And I really think, a lot of this really is rooted in the universities. And I think that a lot of professors have been teaching what I would say is just a very unusual and interesting interpretation of postmodernism that has led to that politics.
And
it's been very dangerous. So what I this is sort of not here nor there, but I think there's a misreading of postmodernists, but whatever.
Have you written
doesn't
about
matter.
That? That's so important.
Because
postmodernism is also being blamed by some people.
Oh, I know. I've been very public about this for a while.
Yeah. So sorry. I'm behind in my reading because I was writing.
On one level, it doesn't really matter, right? Because whatever the dominant interpretation of a text is, that's what's going to determine our culture, that's what's happening. So there is a particular interpretation of the texts of Foucault and Derrida and others that has led to this politics. There's no question about that. But I do think that the universities are really, in some ways, the root of all of this.
And I have to say, law schools have been really bad for many, many decades now. Mm-hmm. You can count on the fingers, maybe of two hands, but not much more than that, the professors who are teaching constitutional law and First Amendment who actually support the classic view of the First Amendment. And what's very odd about that, and it's been a long time that this has been the case, we're a very tight-knit community, and It's the opposite of what's been happening on the Supreme Court, where for all of the divisions on that court and the fracturing on other constitutional law and civil liberties issues, the court is very united mm-hmm. on free speech issues. And why can they not be a model for the rest of society? I have the chance to interview, to sit in your chair, Ruth Bader Ginsburg on mm-hmm. Tuesday. I think I'm going to ask her about that.
Please.
Because, you know, she started her career with the ACLU, and she's been very good on civil liberties as well as civil rights.
Ask her about the Espionage Act for me.
Okay.
Well,
whether it would be upheld, struck down, whether I'm right.
Whether she thinks it should be upheld. That's what I want to know. Right?
She has the Ginsburg rule, which is she'll answer a question about everything except if it might come before the court, which thanks to de Tocqueville, we know could be a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm. Perilous times, I think, coming even more than now. So, well, thank you, Nadine, for this. This was really fascinating and useful, and I really appreciate
it. Oh, it's so much fun. I can't believe how fast it went.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And thanks to your audience.
Thanks.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To sign up for the Renegade University webinars, visit thaddeusrussell.com/courses. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredlisteners.com. Thanks for listening.